Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So the media is critical here because one can talk as much as one likes, and for Thangam, Ronnie and I try to make the case in the House of Commons, but if it's not getting any amplification in the media, then it's not on the immediate agenda of the decision makers. Well, by goodness, it is now.
You're listening to Stop and Search on the Distraction Pieces Network, brought to you by Acast in association with Leak UK, and this is the Parliament podcast. So here we go. Behind your barricades. Yeah, but how long can I stay? Behind your barricades. Where true values seldom stray. Thank you so much for joining us again. And as I said, this is a very special episode. It's the Parliament podcast. We're not entirely sure that many podcasts have been recorded on the parliamentary estate before, because there's a lot of hoops to jump through. We have to list all of our gear that's going through security. We have to have a tight guest list. It was a brilliant day for drug policy. There was a lot of news breaking. We had the case of Billy Caldwell and Charlotte Caldwell, the mum that flew to Canada and back to obtain cannabis oil for her son and severe epilepsy. Home Office originally confiscated the oil and then gave it back under a special licence. Alfie Dingley, a child that was also suffering, that was awaiting a special Home Office licence. Lord William Hague came out in the news the very night before, saying we need to legalise cannabis across the board. There was just lots going on. The media was full of drug policy. And we was lucky enough to be in Parliament speaking about this. So we've got Crispin Blunt MP, who is a Conservative member. We could not do this podcast without him. His office was superb. Thank you so much, Tarsilow, for organising all of this. They honestly did so much for us. Thank you so much. Also, we got Ronnie Cowan MP, who is a friend of ours. He's from SNP. You may have heard him on previous podcasts. And we've got Thangam Debonair, who is from Labour, who is, again, very, very knowledgeable on this issue of drug policy. Let's get on with it. Let's get straight into this. Let's find out what's going on actually in Parliament on drug policy from all of these different political parties. Here we go.
Thank you so much for coming down. As you know, this is quite a strange day for drug policy. There's lots going on. We've got medicinal cannabis that's coming to the forefront with the Alfie Dingley case and Billy Caldwell case. And William Hague, Lord Hague, spoke out today about how we should go further than that and legalise cannabis for the sake of public health. So we've got a lot to talk about on the panel. And there's going to be all sorts of nuances of drug policy as well that we hopefully get to discuss as well. But just a quick mention, what we're doing is a podcast. So this is the Stop and Search podcast that we're going to broadcast later on. And we're officially award-winning now. We've got 2 silver awards. So we at the British Podcast Award, we've got Best Current Affairs, Silver Medal and the Smartest Podcast. And we beat Ed Miliband, I'm sorry to say. He came below us. So. Yes, and Ed Miliband, he did spoke out. After Neve went on the Reasons for Be Cheerful podcast, I think we... A round of applause for Neve, I think. Because it was a genuinely brilliant podcast. And that's, I think, going to lead us to the first question is... Just how the alternative media has played a part in this. We did have Allegra Stratton, who was supposed to be here tonight, but she had to get called away on a job, just as the same as we might have call-outs on our MPs tonight. So, but I think, Ronnie, you're a friend of our podcast, and you've done this before. are we getting to the point now where we're having a social movement from the bottom up, or are we actually now going to actually have some movement within policy making?
No, I think there's been a social movement from the bottom up for some time. I think hopefully what we're seeing, particularly in the last week or so, is people within, not these walls, but across the road, in the Palace of Westminster, actually listening to what's being said. And a lot of it, we have to say, has come from the most tragic stories. I mean, medicinal cannabis or medical cannabis is hot right now. But that's because of the tragic stories we're hearing from Billy Caldwell and Murray Gray and Alfie Dingley. And I was saying earlier on to folk, if you've got somebody in that horrific situation in your constituency and you take that person to your MP, then you'll see individually people starting to say, I get it. I get the use of medical cannabis.
And I think, Crispin, as well, as you've been outspoken on this for a little while now, have you heard personally from constituents, but also through the media, have you heard these stories that are now getting some traction within the policymakers?
Well, it's noticeable the number of colleagues who were rising both on the urgent question yesterday and on the statement today, who are presenting constituents' cases. And I was aware of the Caldwell and the Dingley cases, but not aware of them, people saying there were scores of cases sitting behind them. But now suddenly we're seeing these scores of cases emerge of people who are going to need medicine derived from cannabis. And of course, medicine derived from cannabis is in the places it is in, and this ludicrous scheduling, partly because of the entirely erroneous basis on which our entire drug laws sit. And it all goes back to the war on prohibition and the American system triumphing over the British system, which has been brilliantly documented in Neil's upcoming book. So we should show the book to the watching public. So these things are interlinked, although strictly medicine from cannabis should be a medical issue. And the regulation and licensing of a legal drugs market set against prohibition is, in that sense, a much wider policy discussion about the overall costs and benefits to society of those two policy approaches.
And Thangham, I think that one of the main issues that a lot of us in this audience will have is that drug policy and also medicinal cannabis has fallen under the Home Office and not necessarily the Department of Health. Is there any traction that we can actually have some differences within that policy now?
Will it move to health? Well, I'm the Labour health whip, so the amount of comment I can make on health policy is limited. So I'm going to do a really annoying politician thing and slightly duck your question.
That's absolutely fine.
But I think that it has to be made a health issue. And I think in the question of should we legalise and regulate a whole stack of drugs, the reason for me it has to be a health issue is when you look at the health impacts and you compare them with the two legal drugs, alcohol and tobacco, that you get the clearest arguments for me about why we need to at least be looking at legalization, regulation, because that's how you get the health impacts, and that's how you get the health impacts known about. That's how you get information to people. When I look out of my office window in Bristol, and people say to me, "Oh, we shouldn't have any sort of drug consumption rooms. There shouldn't be any legalisation of drugs because then people will sell drugs." I can look out my office window and watch drugs being sold all the time and consumed. I've seen any number of drugs every single day, and some of them not very pleasantly, some of them very dangerously, some of them putting other people at risk, some of them not particularly dangerously, but they're buying unregulated drugs. They've got no idea what they're buying or selling or taking. Now, I don't want my constituents to be at that much of risk. And so to bring it back to why is it a health issue? Because there are impacts on health. And why would we not at least want to look at a framework which says if I buy a glass of wine at a pub or a bottle of wine from an off license, which I don't because I choose not to drink, but I can get information about that. I can get information which in my view should be better information, but I can at least get some information. If I buy tobacco, I get a great big picture telling me what it's going to do to my health. But for other drugs, there is no information, and that has health consequences.
You took part in some great documentary footage lately on BBC Three where, again, you're at the forefront. You were watching what's going on with people that are suffering with addiction. Can you just give me a bit of an insight in your own personal journey within this, that you've seen what it is like with people that have suffered with trauma that now segue into addiction, and how that affects you as a person and a politician.
It was so mainstream it was even on BBC One after it was on BBC Three. It was an interesting experience because I came to it with my own views, which as a new-ish politician, well, very new politician when I was first approached by the BBC, I was quite nervous about how far I should go with them, but I knew that I had a duty to represent the people in my constituency, and I took the makers of that programme on a walk from my house to my office to point out along the way all the different ways that I could see the current legal system for responding to drugs affecting my constituents, from needles in the ditch to the fact that someone is quite happily stoned over here but has probably not got accurate information about things that he needs to know about what it is he's just consumed, to someone with a serious drug addiction problem and someone else has just been burgled because of the price of their particular drug, and someone else who is probably at serious risk of a mental health problem, but again, partly because they haven't got adequate information. It was a brilliant experience. I mean, taking part in a documentary is pretty risky, but I think it was transformative for my constituency because people have seen what's around them, including in places that they will walk past all the time and never quite realised what was going on, and seen what the impact is.
How much has the media played a part in this, Crispin? Do you think that we are getting to the point now where the people are understanding the nuance of it? Because you frame in terms of legalisation, it straight away scares people. It makes people think free for all. But are we getting to understand what controlled regulation and taxation means now, do you think?
We're starting on the journey, and it's going to be important that the... how the media have... in that sense, shaped our laws is rather well documented in the book, and how the tabloids reacted to various stories in the 1960s and then and subsequently. It's obviously rather important that Mr. Paul Dacre is no longer going to be the editor of the Daily Mail at the end of the year. And I think Geordie Gregg is from what I understand, certainly from the attitude the Mail on Sunday's taken, is rather more open on this issue. However, we've got to see as to how obviously the continuing power of the newspapers, but media is much more diverse than it was before. But the power of the media is really demonstrated this week in the incredibly effective way in which Billy Caldwell's story was picked up and presented to the media, and the once the media got hold of the story, they weren't going to let go. You know, here was a little boy that needed to be saved, and of course it's a great human story just in itself, and of course it had followed the Alfie Dingley story, which is done in exactly the same way, and there was, you know, that campaign was able to get 370,000 signatures on a petition, and then to be taken down Downing Street. So the media is critical here, because one can talk as much as one likes, and for Thangham, Ronnie and I try and make the case in the House of Commons, but if it's not getting any amplification in the media, then it's not on the immediate agenda of the decision makers. Well, by goodness, it is now.
Can you give us a little bit of insight specifically for the podcast of the Alfie Dingley case? Because you were there, both of you, I think, for the going to the Parliament Downing Street and handing over the signatures. And of course, you had public figure support in Patrick Stewart as well as Gillian Lumley. Do we need public figure support? Are we getting to the point now where we need to have that unification, that everybody's having a conversation?
Public figures, I mean, it's a term. What it really means is it's not just about politicians. And people get sick to death of politicians banging on about things. So if somebody they can associate with steps up and says, you know what, I've got nothing in this, I'm not looking for your vote, I'm not going back to you, but I really care about this and I'm informed about this, and yeah, it amplifies the whichever cause they support. A lot of the lobbying that goes on here is backed up by public figures, but that's because it reaches beyond politicians saying to people, you know, vote for me, this is what I'm about, and you don't have any party affiliation either. So people might sort of look at me and think, well, it's SNP, and think, well, I'm not listening to him, simply because he's SNP. That's the deal. Whereas people can look at someone like Patrick Stewart and say, well, he's captain of Starship Enterprise.
And who would argue with that? And I think as well, Crispin, that there is, strangely, what most of us in this room would I think, attest to is that drug policy reform isn't set to one party or another. It is very much cross-party. We do get it from all sections of Labour, Conservative. What is it like within your party at the moment of being quite outspoken on drug policy reform? Is there much within your social circles that agree with you privately, or is it very much a case of what we see on record is how people's stances are?
Now, I'm finding when I began to get engaged in this that you know, colleagues would then be privately quite encouraging. So we would have a debate in the House, and then the minister would have to take the debate, bang out the government line, and then quietly thereafter would be saying, you know, keep going. Obviously, that attitude will vary depending on what the issue is. I mean, the truth of it is that within the Conservative Party now, there is a very difficult to find a colleague who is not supportive of getting medicine from cannabis. It is quite kind of blindingly obvious. There is a significant anxiety about going further than that. Now, the public would appear to be kind of in the same place. So they're kind of probably 80-20 in favour of medicine from cannabis, and the 20 probably just don't understand. But on the wider issue, it's probably 50-50 at the minute. And that reflects the experience in the United States as well, and where the referendums that happened in the states that have produced a legal market have often only just been got over the line. And then the states have had to react because their legislators and regulators have been told to then deliver a regulated licensed market.
But Crispin, do you think that some of that is possibly because people are going on, they're developing their own knowledge of what the impact of our current drug laws are? I noticed when you and I were in Seattle and we were talking to legislators, really interesting lines of argument. One of the lines of argument which I really responded to, and I think a lot of our constituents would, was by destroying the drug dealer's business model, you're actually ultimately going to protect more children from harmful drug use. And that one I mean, it was just so obvious the way he explained it. And when we were on the bus in Seattle, I mean, I use the bus a lot around there, and as the legislator had said, there were all these posters up everywhere where they'd done a lot of data capture of the proportion of children and young people aged, I think it was between 14 and 18, who'd never used drugs. And it was really interesting that they decided to go with actually making drugs legal will make it harder for children and young people to take drugs. And you can really see it in the way that they run their cannabis market. Which is incredibly efficient, very strict. There is nobody smoking outside a cannabis shop. Your ID gets checked as you go in. And I have to say, when I went in the interest of research, you understand, I went in because that guy just told us about it. You see, and I thought, is this really true? So I went with my young man, and we were both asked to show our passports. Now, we were flattered because it's been a long time since either of us been asked how old we were. But then again, you could also... So we asked this guy, you know, what else happens in here to check age? And your ID is checked again at point of sale. And the way the business model is treated, you can kind of see that actually this makes it a lot less attractive for a drug dealer to go and try and sell drugs to children, when actually if you're a regulated, licensed, legal cannabis seller, you can do far better on the regulated market. I thought it was a brilliant argument.
I think Ronnie wanted to say something.
No, it absolutely is a great argument, but if you remember what happened, was it today or yesterday, when we were talking about the medical cannabis, the number of people that stood up in there and said, oh, this is a gateway to recreational cannabis, and if you smoke cannabis, it's going to do your head. You're going to be psychotic. You're going to be, you know, and there's that sort of misinformation out there, which we've got a problem with. And we have to, if we get medical cannabis through, we have to accept that's what we're going after. And for the good of those people who need it right now, that's the end game. Beyond that, we can ruin it, and it will divide a lot of people. A lot of people who will support the medical cannabis have already said, I'm not interested in having this recreationally. But the information out there is, as those people don't currently get, if we regulate it, the stuff which is doing the damage just now will not be available to people. We will know what's in it. It's not going to be cut with all sorts of crap. It's going to cause you all the problems, and that's the barrier they have to get over. And the example you gave there in Seattle is exactly the information we have to give out to people. So I think a wee trip to Seattle is probably in the cards for 650 MPs.
You can follow Thangam and I. But it's what's plainly happening there is that legal supply chain is putting the illegal supply chain out of business, because it's actually a damn sight more expensive to produce something illegally than it is to produce it legally. Your costs of business, of the people you've got to pay and the rest to get your product to market, is significantly greater. And so, if you've got a legal supply chain, now it will take time in the case of the legal cannabis markets for the legally supplied cannabis to begin to significantly have displaced all the illegal supply chain because of the prevalence of the illegal supply chain in the United States. But it will happen. But with other drugs, it is given how the business model works, that would be much more rapid in terms of how a legal supply chain would simply not people worth people's while in the illegal supply of drugs. If we ever get to the stage where we then have a proper assessment and end prohibition. So what's on our side is the evidence.
And also the growing, and I do think it is growing, understanding of the sheer hypocrisy of the fact that this evening, Crispin and Ronnie and I can all go and purchase at least one very, very legal drug very, very easily on the estate of the Palace of Westminster. And it's called alcohol. And that is legal. And I'm not arguing for it to be illegal, but it is legal. It does cause cancer. It does cause various other diseases. It does contribute to various forms of antisocial behaviour. It's a contributing factor, not a causal factor, but it's there. And we can go and buy that legally, but it's regulated. And at least I know if I went to buy a bottle of wine, what would be in it would be wine. And that I would be able to tell what percentage alcohol it was and those sorts of things. And I think that I find my conversations with colleagues are gradually people are understanding that the arguments don't stack up. If you make an argument about this particular drug being bad for you, therefore it should remain illegal, well, so is alcohol and so is tobacco. And we've found a way to live with that by regulating the heck out of both of them.
And that's the thing. I think most of us use that argument, is that we're good at regulating things in this country. And within that regulation system, you can do tweaks like minimum price.
And the drugs minister last year, do you remember, Christopher? She said, the then drugs minister said, her motto to her kids was, if you can't buy it in Boots, don't take it. And which was absolutely ridiculous, because I'd sat in Boots earlier that week with a guy who'd come in to collect to have his legally prescribed heroin, which he consumed about 2 metres away from me. So in Boots. And so that argument doesn't stack up. It doesn't make any sort of sense. Plus, you can legally in Boots buy all sorts of opiate drugs, which arguably are causing people an awful lot of harm and which are incredibly addictive. So there are all sorts of holes in those arguments. Now, the difference I've seen is that they're being made in Parliament. All sorts of members of Parliament are making those arguments. And even if we're not saying, therefore, I think you should do X, just the fact that we're raising them and saying, there's a problem here, there's a problem here, there's a problem here, I think that's real progress.
And that is a great point, is that we can see on our doorstep existing models. In my hometown, we've got a Boots that does the methadone dispensing system. On the counter, there's a leaflet saying, if you've got drug and alcohol problems, seek help, and this is the number you can call. So why, when we've got this model of compassion and understanding, what has held us back at this point, Ronnie? Why have we still got a position? Is it the media? Is it just intransience?
Nothing happens quickly in this place, and I've always said before, unless there's votes in it, it's very hard to get politicians to get behind it. There are always going to be some who will see the worthy cause and say, that's something I've got to go after. But it's also pressure from whips, it's pressure of the government to stay in power. You can imagine if the government turned around tomorrow and said, you know what, drugs, let's legalise them all. You know? What position would that put them in? They may turn out to be the biggest vote winner of all time, but they don't know that. They'll be benchmarking this, they'll be trying and testing, they'll be putting behind the scenes, they'll be doing surveys left, right and centre, what's people's views on this? Once a party see that's the views of people, that tends to be the path they're going to go down. So they'll be doing lots of research behind this, I hope, because it might open their eyes to lots of things. But ultimately, what's slowed it down is this place moves slowly, and yes, the media from a long, long time ago started there, you know, drugs are crazy. I've only just started reading Neil's second book, but already I'm into the bit with the tabloid paper, tabloid newspapers are going hard on amphetamines. You know, that was the first one they got amphetamines and said, oh, this is bad stuff, you know, and then made it illegal, and that's when the trouble kicked off. You know? And there'd be road back then, said, oh, stop, we got it wrong. The whole drug scene, the whole could be completely different now. They don't like to admit they're wrong. And even this medical cannabis, we get medical cannabis to go through a panel of experts to say, yeah, you can have it and you can have it. There's 10,000 people knocking on the door saying, I've got exactly the same symptoms. They're going to take their time before they say, okay, we're going to allow GPs to prescribe this for you? Because if they do it overnight, that means we got it wrong.
The environment is changing. So you've got the Global Commission on Drugs Policy with, 15 former heads of state on that, with people like George Shultz and Kofi Annan and the rest. I mean, that is a very authoritative body that have kind of looked at what's happened in their own countries. And obviously, sadly, once they're out of office, they've gone, well, hang on a minute, this is we're not in the right place in terms of a policy in our countries. And if you're being the president of Mexico or Colombia and everything else, and your entire country has been at risk of collapse in front of the cartels who are then running a business in that area, you have a very clear view about the merits of prohibition as a policy. So there's a global conversation going on, and I suppose on the back of that global conversation, which obviously led into the 2016 UN UN Assembly looking at this, it didn't quite go to plan. But there's always going to be probably opposition, it would appear, from the Russians and Chinese. We have to work out a way to work our way around that in the short to medium term. But for me as a politician, you asked what my colleagues thought about it. I have felt able to get into this debate. It is true, partly because I've slid off the greasy pole in both parliamentary and ministerial terms. And I've probably got another decade in this place, I hope, electorate willing. And this is a huge issue. I was prisons minister for 2.5 years, so I saw what the consequences were within the criminal justice system. And because I left school aged 18 to go straight into the army and then was a serving soldier whilst I was at university, I'm one of those sad politicians who's actually able to ask the question, have you ever used it at university? And the answer is no. The first time I took cannabis was visiting San Francisco and Seattle over Easter, where I'd helped myself to a mint or two. To see what the effect was. Frankly, I didn't like it very much, so I wouldn't actually in that sense recommend it to people. But it'll have a different effect on different people. And so perhaps I then found myself in a rather unique position of being able to step into this debate. But I actually feel that this debate is much more mainstream now, even than it was 2 years ago. And one is not. So wildly eccentric, taking this up as an issue as one was before. And today has been a huge day in terms of moving the debate on in the UK. And for William Hague to that article today, the coincidence of the two events today, the statement saying they're going to review medical cannabis, and William Hague's article in the Telegraph, this is a red letter day for reform.
Also, Ed Miliband spoke out today as
yeah,
well.
Yeah, I mean, and I think he won't be the only one in the coming days. I mean, Jeff Smith and I are launching the Labour campaign for drug policy reform. Can't remember how we worded it. We're having our launch event soon, and that's to try and get Labour members in my party sort of interested in why we need reform. So, and what we've done is we've been quite cautious in saying we're not prescribing anything. We're asking you to acknowledge that the current system doesn't work, and then what we'll do is try and work out how we go from here. Jeff and I have got our own views, but we think that it would be good if we brought our party with us. And sometimes that sort of nudge and sort of carrot thing, you know, you have to work that. But I felt today was a really huge day. I mean, some people said things both in and out of the chamber that I never thought I'd hear said. And that's a huge deal. And I do think that matters. I think that matters that all of you know this, because I think if you don't have a degree of public support, it's very difficult. You think of Paul Flynn. I mean, he's been rattling on this policy issue. It's going to go any minute, isn't it? Paul Flynn's been trying to get this through 4 years, but for ages he's just been, you know, Flynn's doing that thing again. And now there it is. So we have to go because we have 8 minutes to go and vote against each other or something. We'll try and come back.
So what happened here, you may have heard it in the background, is the division bell rang, and what that is essentially a voting alarm. So it goes off and then MPs have to rush to the yes lobby or the no lobby to register their vote, which means it was about 20 minutes of our MPs. But it's okay because there was such a knowledgeable audience that we picked on a few. We've got Steve Rolls from Transform Drug Policy Foundation, who you would have heard on previous podcasts of ours. We've also got Neve Eastwood from Release, who's coming up on future podcast episodes. And of course, we've got Neil Woods, who is chairperson of Elite UK, friend of mine, former undercover detective, and author of the new book, Drug Wars. We have a chat amongst ourselves, and then the MPs come back. We're lucky to have Ronnie Cowan come back and also Crispin Blunt. Thangham Debonair had to leave at this point, so we thank him very, very much for contributing. So let's get straight back into this then, and I'll speak to you at the end. This is the second part.
Today has been a strange old day, and everything seems to be kicking off. You two have been in the reform a lot longer than what we have, but that doesn't mean to sound bad. Don't laugh at that. That's not an insult, honestly. I insulted Danny Kushlett, the founder of Transform recently. I called him the grandfather of reforms, which, like, and it was a tweet. She would have thought I would have thought of that. But anyway, Steve, in your tenure in drug policy reform, does it feel different at the moment?
Yeah, I think it seems like there's a combination of factors have moved the sort of political environment to a point where change suddenly doesn't just seem possible. It's beginning to seem quite likely. And I think things like William Hague coming out calling for legalisation, which isn't something you would have guessed was going to happen at all, and Ian Duncan Smith calling for supporting medical cannabis, things like that, which are just really quite surprising. Maybe they're not that surprising. I mean, I think you've seen authoritative voices like, you know, the British Medical Journal coming out and out calling for legalisation of all drugs and regulation from a public health perspective. You've seen the Times editorial calling for legalisation of all drugs. You've seen increasing numbers of NGOs from different fields getting on board, from development and from economics and from all over the place, saying, yes, this needs to happen, this impacts on us. And you've seen public figures and just the media debate and the public debate just seems to have moved on markedly to a place where people are feeling safe to talk about it now. And I think we're not there yet, but we are rapidly approaching a tipping point. And I think what's happened this week is testimony to that.
And that's a really good point, is how safe people feel in voicing. And I think Neve is that you're a good person to that, both in the organisation. If you don't know who Neve is from, she's from Release, a massive organisation that deal with, well, if you can explain, Neve.
So Steve needed no introduction. So Release is the UK centre.
I just didn't get one.
Release is the UK centre of expertise on drugs and drug laws, and we provide legal services to people who use drugs both recreationally and problematically, and campaign for reform of the drug laws, and in particular to end the criminalisation of possession and personal use offences across all drugs. So that's what we do.
And do you think that people are feeling safer now in a public realm to actually have a voice on this? Because before, you could argue it is, well, some people argued it was political suicide to step up and voice for reform. But do you think now people are realising that there is a wrong side of history here and they could be about to make some jumps?
I mean, I think if we're talking specifically about political characters, then yes, absolutely. I think politicians feel that there is a space to have this conversation. And I have to say, I think that's resulted not just because of recent events, but if we go back to the establishment of the Global Commission on Drug Policy in 2011 and the influence that these people have had on the global debate and legitimized it in some way. So as you pointed out, Steve and I are long in the tooth in this game, probably too long. But honestly, I don't know if you'd agree, Steve, but back in the noughties when we used to do media, it did kind of feel like you were a bit left field, that you were treating like you were kind of just doing this because, you know what, you wanted to get stoned whether you were a drug user or not. But I feel like once you had that legitimacy and that cover, that suddenly the debate became a relevant debate and a debate that was worth having and one that was based on evidence. And I think that cannot be ignored here, that all of the NGOs that have been involved in this field, everybody from the Global Commission, Transform, ourselves, LEAP, others across the globe, have really worked to build the evidence base here. I mean, so these decisions happening now are not happening in the absence of evidence. It's because of that foundation that I think it's contributed. And obviously this week, the stories of those mums and their kids has just been heartbreaking. And the fact that the government moved so quickly, like I don't think I've ever seen a government move so fast to make sure that they could at least deal with Billy's case over the weekend. So I think those human stories have been fundamentally important, but also to all the hard work that everybody in this room and NGOs, anyone's child, all of the great campaigns across the globe have really sort of helped to build that.
And that is key, isn't it, Neil, is that we can attest to that in what we do, the mixing of the personal testimonies, both from law enforcement, but also who, I mean, you make it clear in your previous book and this book, the people that you've harmed doing a policing role. And do you think we're actually getting to the point now where we're actually managed to have that conversation?
Well, yes, I hope so. I mean, that's one thing I found encouraging from what William Hague said today, is that he mentioned organised crime. And that's often, from my point of view, missing from the conversation, that we need to talk. We need to realise just how bad things are. And I should mention the name of the book, shouldn't I, you think? It's called Drug Wars. It's written together with my brilliant co-writer who's in the audience there, J.S. Raffaele. And basically, I hope that it shows just how bad things are, actually, just how far the corruption from organised crime has come. So I hope that side of the conversation is going to become more prevalent now that there's more political voices speaking about it.
So this was all just a ruse, for a book launch, really.
I thought we were going to do a Drug Wars special.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, Nate.
No, just to say and to add, I mean, I think part of the cover that politicians have are the fact that police forces across the country are actually recognising the failure of drug policy. And we have police officers here tonight. I don't know if you want me to mention you on podcast, but okay. So from Thames Valley Police, people like Jason Q, who are showing huge leadership on this issue, recognising the futility of the current approach, and in the absence of national leadership, are actually implementing drug policy reform locally. And that's probably been one of the most exciting things in our work, I think, in the last 2-3 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think the absence of leadership from central government, that void has to a significant extent been filled by local authorities and local police forces, with a whole series of initiatives. So the diversion schemes, kind of de facto decriminalisation of possession. We've seen the drug testing at festivals and now in city centres for users to use. And we've seen a big push for supervised drug consumption spaces. And that's all come from local government showing the leadership that central government has failed to do. And that's been enormously important. And I think that's, you know, probably going to be the pattern for the foreseeable future. And it's just part of this sort of combination. It's all sort of, a lot of things seem to be aligning. So you've got the human stories, you've got the local initiatives, you've got the sort of authoritative voices from the police and the medical agencies. You've got the international reform. I mean, cannabis legalization is, for example, is no longer a theoretical sort of debate down the pub. It's, you know, California is doing it. Canada is legalizing cannabis this week nationally. Uruguay's already done it. Multiple states. I was in Denmark last week in the Denmark Parliament with, and they were sort of, you know, discussing not if they should legalize, but what the best way to do it was. And Denmark could well be the first country to legalize cannabis in the EU. And there's another. It'd be a domino effect, I think, a bit like in. In the US, once one country does it in the EU, Spain and Italy and the Netherlands and a whole bunch of other places are just lining up to follow suit. They just need that sort of little bit of license to move forward with it. So there's all sorts of things happening, and it just feels like drug reform has the work has been done, the water has built up behind the dam, and the cracks are showing. It's about to be unleashed, I think.
And that is key, I think, with what Niamh said, is that When the PCC role was conceived, there's a lot of people that were sceptical about it. It to politicise the police force didn't necessarily make sense, but it's been such a benefit to what we do in our sector, isn't it? It was that you can do these tangible reforms on the ground. And we are getting to that point now, like we said, with Jason and Mike Barton, Ron Hogg in Durham, Arthur Jones in Wales. Do you think we are going to get a police-led reform approach as well as what's going on within the political motions?
Yeah, I think so. As Steve said, I think that's going to continue. I mean, we've only had a hint of what's going to be achieved in the West Midlands, I think, with David Jameson. I mean, he's working hard to develop those policies and to sell them. And he was only in Switzerland a couple of weeks ago looking at how heroin-assisted treatment works there. And I think he's going to continue to be a great advocate. I mean, in West Mids, it's the second biggest police force in the country. And we know from Durham that when police do these things, then evidence comes from it, and it's evidence that we follow. And that's it, to back up another thing that that both Niamh and Steve have said is that this is as a result of the movement growing over time and providing the evidence. And because I remember as a detective sergeant being incredibly disillusioned with our drug policy and seeing how vulnerable people were being crushed by current drug policy, I was actually inspired by reading everything I could from Transform and Release, and I certainly wouldn't have been able to go into doing reform unless they had those publications.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And again, round of applause for Steve and Niamh, because I have genuinely been at the forefront of this. So. It was. I learned from you two as I came into this. You start off and you feel naive. You don't know what's going on.
You really are making us feel old.
We're going to have a Christmas party and everything. But I did. I generally felt naive when I came into this. I didn't know how to do the campaigning work. So you talk so much. And Niamh, at the moment, you've got an absolutely amazing initiative at the moment with the app, what's going on. We spoke to Avinash about it last week when we was in the Waterstones with Jonathan Miller from Channel 4 News, just a name drop, talking about the Philippines. Can you give us a bit of background on what's going on with the app?
Well, firstly, I should say our head of legal services, Kirsty Dice, who is in the audience tonight, is the architect behind the app. So not myself. But essentially, it's an app. It's also supported with guide and a video, loads of videos on our website, which really empowers people to navigate the criminal justice system when they're caught in possession of drugs. So currently, legal aid, because we know austerity has bitten all parts of society, but in particular, the criminal justice system. So legal aid is no longer available for possession offences. So people are having to go to court unrepresented. They'll get representation at a police station for interview. But the idea is that if you've been caught in possession of a drug, say cannabis, you can work out what the right penalty is for you. So for example, if it's your first occasion, you should get a cannabis warning. However, if the police are arresting you and threatening you with prosecution, then you often feel lost. So what this does is allow you to work out, well, I should ask for that because that's what the guidance says. And if they refuse and go ahead, we provide you with template letters that you can then write to the CPS and say, under the guidance, I should have got a cannabis warning. Please put this back to the police so I can get a cannabis warning. And if that doesn't work, then you can go to court and present all of those letters and all of the arguments to the court in the hope that they will exercise their power and ensure that justice is met and send people back. So it covers all drugs. It's a brilliant piece of work. I suggest everybody goes online, release.org.uk. It's on the front page. Download the app. Yeah, make sure you know your rights.
Absolutely brilliant. Round of applause for Niamh, I think.
Just one thing to mention before we go back to the MPs is that next week on the 26th, that's Tuesday, it's UN World Anti-Drugs Day, which has been significantly reclaimed by the drug law reform movement in the form of the Support Don't Punish campaign, which is active in 180 cities around the world. And this year in London, activities being organised by Anyone's Child, the Anyone's Child campaign. This is their T-shirt I'm wearing. And they're going to be meeting in Parliament Square. What time, Jane?
College Green at 2 o'clock.
College Green at 3 o'clock. And then we're going to be processing into the into Parliament to meet with a whole load of MPs. And I'm pleased to say about 15 MPs have said they will come and meet with us already. And hopefully we'll be getting a few more before then. So we're going to get people who've been impacted by the drug war, activists, and a whole range of people are going to be getting involved, telling MPs that they feel it's time to end the war on drugs and begin a debate on reform. So I hope that as many people as possible can join us then. And if you want to get more information, check out the Anyone's Child website or speak to Jane afterwards. Thanks very much.
Applause for Anyone's Child. And Jane is just such a worker on this. I take my hat off to you in so many different ways, Jane, for organising this. And if you can get to it next week, please do, because how can you argue with Anyone's Child? And actually, I think I've framed that in a question. Ronnie, how can you argue with Anyone's Child?
I wasn't planning on arguing with Anyone's Child.
Do it.
No, as I've stated earlier, I don't know if we're recording that, but I found one of the most powerful things is when you get that personal testimony. And if you can find somebody, it's a horrible thing to say, but if you could find somebody in that situation, every single constituency, and take them to your MP, then you're home and dry. Because that's how you win it. A good example there. Everything comes down to us walking through lobbies. I don't know which lobby you walk through there. Obviously, presumably different. Yeah, in that case, not the one I was in, as I've learned down here. Yeah, yeah. But that's what it comes down to. It comes down to, six speaker doesn't vote and all that sort of contrivance, but it comes down to MPs walking through a lobby that say aye or no. And that's ultimately how it's done. So if you can convince enough to walk through the lobby you want to walk through, given that the government don't play games and kill bills and talk them out and do all the things that they can play at, but if you get to that point where you've got a vote and you've convinced enough MPs to vote one way, and a lot of these things could be votes of conscience, in which case the whip's not applied. If the whip's not applied, you're really in with a shout. That's the game we play. Yeah.
So, the question's quite an important one. And obviously, we have the arguments against Anyone's Child that come from the campaign group that happens to be based in the Prime Minister's constituency. Now, I've now forgotten her name, the exact name of the campaign group. People in here will know. There's a fam drug, is it? What's it called? Drug fam. And the person who leads that? Elizabeth. As you can tell, this is an expert audience, obviously a lot more expert than me. But at least I remember that it existed and it was there. And you've then got people who are then arguing for prohibition, that that the only proper route is abstinence, and that if you've got people addicted, you've then got to get them abstinent to get them. That's got to be the objective of treatment. And I have certainly learnt in time, not particularly from in the last year, but I've become much more suspicious about the management of drug addiction and drug use, of saying that the only answer is addiction is abstinence, and that you keep going around the boy, supported by this very expensive industry that's going to give you residential treatment to get you clean, and you keep on doing it until you've got the message and you're clean. And the fact is that there are obviously a entire range of how people are able to survive and hold down jobs of all sorts with some varying degrees of drug use within within their life. And all of us will have seen people who have got themselves into a mess with alcohol, which of course is quite a dangerous, pretty dangerous drug in the list of drugs. And how are people able to manage that? And you can see whether there are sometimes I just think that the kind of AA, NA approach is rather, it's good for some people, it might be great for a lot of people, but it is not the only answer. And we've got to need to get a better understanding of supporting people when they get into a mess with whatever drug they're using. And so the message therefore being given by the you know, the abstinence brigade is yes, they might be right for some people who've got out of control, and that might be the only place that they're going to get control back over their lives. But I think for a lot of other people, they can be taught responsible use.
I think it can be quite surprising for people that work in the sector that the Conservatives were pretty forward-thinking in the 80s with needle exchange and implemented it against, you know, public opinion in many ways. Do you think you can have that same position again, where it won't be against public opinion now, because I think, I mean, certainly polls from Transform show that people are very much understanding job law reform. But do you think the Conservatives can lead again on this issue?
Well, in the 1980s, we were faced with the HIV/AIDS emergency. And the country was extremely lucky to have Norman Fowler as the health secretary at the time, which is why he, to many gay men, he's a hero. He saved, his reaction to that, he saved a shed load of lives, and equally for, obviously, for drug users. And the emergency then was, how do we stop this spreading? Needle exchange is obviously a very sensible policy development to try and reduce the spread. And in those circumstances, he started to play, took the decision. I don't know the exact history of the decision making, how much of it had to be cleared by cabinet and the rest, or whether he just did it as health secretary. But certainly the cabinet and the whole government under Margaret Thatcher clearly signed up to the whole HIV/AIDS agenda, which I think in the UK was probably one of the more substantial public health successes that can be claimed for probably any global administration. It contrasted with what was happening in the United States under in the Reagan administration. It took quite a long time, I think, to get to the to get to that place and get seized of the importance of it. And so one would hope that the joy of the Conservative Party is that we, when the evidence changes, we change. And so we are, in the end, we're ultimately a very pragmatic party. And there are some ideologues, and they're regarded with pretty grave suspicion. And we'll take some inspiration from them. But in the end, pragmatism will out.
It's interesting, Ronnie. It's the same arguments again that when people put in opposition to needle exchange, it was because it was drug enabling. It was because it was against moral code. And it's the same position we got now against drug consumption rooms as against medical cannabis. People are still arguing a moral position. Where are the morals? Are they subjective? Do you think we've got a moral obligation to actually save lives just as we did in the HIV epidemic?
I think there's still a feeling in some aspects of society that a drug consumption room is enabling people to take drugs. The fact that they're already taking drugs doesn't seem to register with them. And the problem we've had in Glasgow was that the needle exchange was closed because of the detritus which was necessarily travelling from it into the surrounding area. And understandably, people get annoyed if they're going to their bins and there's used needles and bloody wipes and stuff like that sitting there. So we said, great solution here, drug consumption rooms. Yeah, we'll give you the needles, you can consume it in the room, everything's safe, everything's supervised, fantastic. And we thought we were getting there. Slight hiccup in the law. And what we need is maybe the moral compass of the Conservative Party to swing in that direction and say, you know what, drug consumption is actually a very good idea for all the good ideas, for safe consumption, for the neighbourhoods, for a whole host of reasons. We know that DCRs work, and they work very, very well. But at this moment in time, and I'm not being too political on this, we know that the Home Office are completely against it. And because, from what they've stated in this fact, they're very badly briefed. The facts and figures they're putting down simply don't stand up to any sort of scrutiny. So they've gone back into their silo, saying we're right and you're wrong, and that's where we currently stand.
Do you think devolved powers are going to play a part in this? Do you think we are actually going to get movement within Scotland and Wales, which could potentially put pressure on Westminster?
It's understandably our position. Every time Westminster say we're not going to do that for you, we say, well, give us the powers, we'll make it happen. And in DCRs, that's certainly one of the areas we've said that. Give us the laws in Scotland and we will implement DCRs, first of all in Glasgow, and then there's a need, or every major town and city needs one. So we will do that in Scotland, given the powers. I'd like to think, this is obviously it's a worldwide problem, other people are talking about it, we know Arthur Jones and Ron Hogg and stuff like that. If they can get one road out, I think if we get one road out in any city, in any part of the United Kingdom, other areas will look at it and say, we want one of those. Because they'll simply see it from day one, the problems it solves. It shouldn't be a political thing. It's compassion. It's not about any sort of political doctrine. But I think the resistance with public, which is what the question about, is simply a case of thinking, you hear it with time. The language becomes very difficult to me. But here people are saying, you know, these druggies are doing this, and they get that for nothing, and that's the attitude. And we've stigmatised people who have got drug addiction problems, people who are problematic users, and it's convenient to stigmatise them and use them as the, sort of the butt of all our grievances in life. I've not got this because we're spending so much taxpayers' money on that. Why have we not got enough nurses when we're doing this? Why have we not got enough police on the beat? We're supporting that druggie at the end of the road. He's getting this and he's shooting on his arm. And that's a scapegoat for society, which the media certainly like to play their part in.
what kind of conversations we discussed medical cannabis and cannabis and the conversations that you have privately. Is there much of an appetite within the parties for drug consumption rooms and a movement on heroin assisted treatment?
Is this MP policy?
Well, plainly it's not the government position, as we saw in the response from the government to the debate Ronnie had on drug consumption rooms. But there is a shed load of evidence out there of other countries who have drug consumption rooms and are able to evidence the benefit from it. And I obviously still need to see the fallout from the drugs minister's response to Ronnie's debate when she had been badly briefed on what has happened in Canada. And so we need to concentrate on the evidence, and that's how we, and in the end, that's how we can advance this, and how other countries have managed the contradiction about having a safe space for people to take illegally supplied heroin into a drug consumption room and then safely shoot up with something that they have acquired criminally. There are some rather ugly compromises with the criminal law in that whole of that process, and what's then required of the police. In order to enable those drug consumption rooms to function safely. Now, obviously, all of that gets addressed if you have a proper debate about prohibition and you move to a different legal framework. But it's in the meantime, it's also about changing society's attitudes towards drug addicts and our inability really to see people as people deserving of sympathy and help. And in my time in the prison system, I've been aware of saying the saddest thing I saw in visiting 70 prisons is the queue for methadone. Emaciated men queuing up to make sure they take their medicine, so the nurse supervises that they actually swallow the stuff, so they don't take it back to their cell and to trade it later. And you kind of know that these people will have sustained their addiction as part of the source of 50% of acquisitive crime in the UK. And when they're released, they're almost certainly going to go straight back into the same cycle. This is not a terribly intelligent place to be. And actually, those people are deserving... they're deserving of support as humans who've got themselves into it. Our fellow citizens who've got themselves into a frightful mess and need help, but they're incredibly expensive. And it would be an idea. There's an enormous amount that can be done in terms of payment by results of actually proper support to people like that to reduce the burden on society by helping them get well. And a lot of that is about society's attitude to them. And it's too easy just to, one sense, say, yeah, they've got themselves into that mess. But it's actually in our interest that we help get them out of it.
Do you think this is where the conversation around mental health in general come in, is to make people realise that when we are having a discussion about drug dependency, it's not about the drugs. It's about someone's life circumstances, possible childhood trauma. Are we having that conversation now? Do you think we can actually grasp that within the media as well?
I think in circles we are, but I have not really seen that in mainstream media. Maybe I'm just reading the wrong newspapers. But the start was how to be. I came into this when I was first standing for election in 2015. The one against who stand against me was for the party, cannabis is less harm than alcohol. So I got to know this guy during the course of the campaign. At the end of the campaign, I was voting for him. So he got me going. I started rolling on it and learning about it. And one of the stats which hit me was that 90% of people consuming drugs don't have a problem. And it's that there's still this he takes drugs and it's thank him touched on earlier on. Alcohol is okay, First of all, I've lost count, 15 bars in this place. Not that I go to them, but I keep on doing the sort of research of it. And people get bladdered in this place day in, day out. Yeah? Some of them even go and talk to the chamber. Yeah? That's like I said, but societies have said alcohol was okay. Yeah, but others, I digress there, but we know, it's frustrating, and I know I'm talking to an audience that knows this as well as I do. We know, we understand that people who are driven into addiction problem have come probably from poverty, certainly from some sort of abuse, whether it be sexual abuse or physical abuse during their childhood, and that takes up a whole load of people who have then got in there. There's a small number of people who've actually got a kick out of it, and it's become like a chemical attachment to their brain. That's a very small number over the whole piece, and I don't think that message is actually getting forward to society yet. It's still a case of people take drugs, they don't want to take drugs. They put the needle in their arm, their problem.
there are some really surprising statistics like that one, the fact that 90% of people that consume drugs do it unproblematically. I don't know if we're remotely able to have that conversation in society, that drug use predominantly is not problematic. And I think...
Well, that's exact. That's works for alcohol as it does for drugs that are illegal.
Is it... Because a previous podcast guest of ours was mentioning the bars in the House of Commons. Is it as prevalent as what we'd imagine, the drinking culture around here? Because the outside looking in, we have a certain position. This leads me up to a question about our perception of Westminster, because a lot of people do think that the Westminster bubble is exactly that. I come from Kent. When I come into Westminster, it is a different world. Are we, is Westminster in touch with the general public, is what I'm getting at?
No. That's a very long question for a very short answer. This place is... It's many things, but it's not in touch. It's a museum. It's an art gallery. It's an office block. It's the functioning legislator for the United Kingdom. But it's so insular, and it's designed that way. You can come in here in the morning on the tube. We've got our own private entrance from the tube station, so you can walk in there, not even talk to the public, because goodness knows we don't want to do that. They might educate us. So we come in here, you can get your breakfast in here, you can have a bath in here. Yeah? You can get your hair cut in here, we've got our own post office in here. Life is in here, there's cash machines, restaurants, and you can do what you've got to do during the course of the day, and even as a late sitting, it's 10:30, 11 o'clock at night, you can then go back and tube, or in fact, if you stay late, you're allowed to get a taxi home, and you'll get paid for that as well. You get paid, that gets paid for you, I think an hour after the usual sitting time. I say that because I never use it. So you could be very insular in this place. At the end of the week, go back to your constituency and live within a constituency which you know, and maybe you're very well supported, and not step out and not see real life, and not walk up by, you know, Tottenham Court tube station where there's hundreds of people I can see sleeping rough in that particular part of town right now. And it's very easy. If you want to, you can simply live within the Westminster bubble and do your job. Strangely, although sometimes the bane of my life, social media can drag people out of that, because you're now accessible. Through your phone, through your iPad, people can ping me all the time and say, you know, where are you? What are you doing? You know, and I get that a lot. Why are you not in the chamber discussing this topic? Well, I'm doing something else. But it does mean people are watching. They're watching on telly. They're watching all the time. And so we get hounded. It does sometimes feel like hounding from people who would berate me no matter what I do. But it can have a very positive function in actually holding all elected members to account. But I think historically, it would have been very easy just to lose yourself within the bubble of Westminster. And maybe that sounds like a cliche, but it's absolutely true.
I would just be a tad more positive about this institution than Ronnie. That what we all have in common is that we are all constituency members of Parliament. And so however much one exists in the bubble here whilst Westminster is functioning, and we are here incredibly busy, there are... So Ronnie and I take an interest in drugs, and that will take up some of our time as members of Parliament. Then we've also got our constituencies, and we've got all the other stuff we're interested in. I don't know whether Ronnie has a front bench role in the as a spokesman of the SNP, but that's quite likely to be part of one's career here. So you have all sorts of different roles to play within your team and the rest. Frankly, I don't quite know how people find the time to get stuck into the stranger's bar or the smoking room for any alien exam, because I can't. I don't find time for it. Perhaps I need lessons from Ronnie in time management. But within that...
I didn't know there was a smoker's room. There's a smoker's room.
No, it's called a smoking room. You can't smoke in there. That's all changed.
Regulations.
But we all go back to our constituencies. And then the golden link of the constituency system is kind of the golden argument for it, is that we remain anchored in our constituencies. Now, you could choose to not meet anyone in your constituency and not engage at all, but then I suspect that your party and your constituents are going to get are not going to be wildly enthusiastic about someone who is not engaged in their local constituency in that way.
But there are some safe seats. I mean, I've got a majority of 384, so I'm working all day and all night to keep that. But there are some safe seats. And historically, I think, going back in a few years, there were more safe seats than there are now. You know, certainly in Scotland, the SNP was shaken up, and there are no safe seats now. They're all up for grabs, which is good, because it keeps all 59 of us honest down here. Not that if you get my drift. But if you've got a very safe seat, then you can go back and say, I've got a majority of 14,000. What? If you're of that mind, I'm not saying they are, but the situation could be there if you're of that mind.
Gee, thanks, Ronnie.
What's your majority?
17. But the point is, you can't take anything for granted. Not least because you're okay. I will accept. I mean, okay, Reigate did vote Liberal in 1910. But the point is, you have to not only satisfy your electorate, you've got to satisfy your selectorate as well, and they will want a good representative of the party. Now, it does mean you have you will be constantly being a face on the be accused. Yeah, you're taking it for granted. You're taking the piss. You're not doing anything, and you can't get away with that. And you certainly shouldn't be able to get away with it. You've still got to serve your constituents. I'm, you know, after 20 years here, I am thrilled that I've got, you know, probably the best team of people working for me than I've ever had, and I know that the service they help me give my constituents when they come forward with problems and everything else is as good as it's been. But that quality has got to be sustained, and there is much, much more demand on us now than there was when I was first elected.
And I can totally vouch for both of you, actually, that your office is brilliant to work with. Tarsilow, who I know he's there. Thank you so much, Tarsilow, for today. We would not be here today without Tarsilow. Thank you so much. And Ian as well at your office. Both absolutely superb. And we're going to have to wrap up now. I'm not sure. Well, I don't know if we're going to get Thangham back, are we? I think she's lost in the lobby somewhere.
She did say at me on the way, I think I've said everything I've got to say.
So we're going to do a little bit of a wrap up now. And I think a good point to do is that you both touched on it there is two things. International pressure, how much is that playing a part on drug policy reform? And also social media, how much is that holding you to account on drug policy reform as a round?
I don't know if international pressure, good examples coming from around the world, allows us to put pressure on the government to say that works. And we talked about earlier on, Thangham mentioned, and Chrisman as well, that we had a debate in the Westminster Hall where the drug minister, Victoria Atkins, was badly advised. And she misquoted, or she disrespected the process that they've got going in Canada and said, oh, that's been, they tried to get rid of it. And on the back of that, the Canadian, the people responsible for it wrote to her and said, no, we didn't. We like it. Thank you very much. You were wrong, which was good of them. And I thank you for doing that. But she also made the statement that there was only one DCR in Barcelona that's only open 2 hours a day. And that was wrong. We knew that was wrong. So we tried to push her on that. And I'm going to Barcelona this summer on my summer holidays at my own expense. And I fully intend to go around to see DCR and taking a picture of it and sending it back. Yep, absolutely. So that, which takes on to social media. And that's the idea of social media, you know.
You can do a tour of all the DCRs in Spain to demonstrate there's more than one.
It would take a long time, and that's the point.
I think that's an Instagram post anyway, I think.
Instagram?
Instagram, yeah. I'm the same, I hate it.
Yeah. So that is the point. We can, and social media, you know, we put out tweets, and they can, if the right person retweets it, it can hit 100,000 people. Yeah, how many take it on board? But it's that we, in all campaigns, we've got in the history of putting leaflets through doors. You know, if you put through 10,000 leaflets, you know, 9,000 of them go straight in the bin. 1,000 people read them, 100 people engage in it, and 10 people really get the message you're putting through there. But it's because you're banked every single door and put through every single leaflet. With a tweet, you can do that sort of same thing. So social media is absolutely a way of us putting a message out there, but also for us learning. The number I sit today and I follow tweets, and I see a link, and I go and read an article with somebody. I wasn't going to read William Hague's article. Because yeah, I said earlier on, someone says SNP, they go, well, I'm not reading that. I see William Hague, I thought, I'm not reading that. But I knew it was about in a tweet, so I followed the link.
Is that you?
We're okay in adjournment. So I followed the link and I read the article. And without that being there, I'm not going to sit there and read every single newspaper been printed that day. Some people do, some people go to the tea room, that's their morning routine. Get all the papers out of the newspaper and go flooding all through them. But if I can do it through social media, and I know the people I'm following, the people tend to be, I've got similar interests, whether it be drugs or gambling or changing the laws on a range of things, then that makes it easier for me to engage in the good stuff. But also, I think I have the discipline to go reading the stuff where I disagree with it and see what people are saying about it as well.
How would you respond to that, Chris? Would you agree that we've got international examples that we can follow, and also is social media making an impact nowadays in policy making?
Social media certainly makes you busier and gives you and is then but is then drawing you to areas exactly as Ronnie points out that you're then becoming aware of things you wouldn't be aware of. it is, of course, then the obsession with having the, you know, the phone is constantly there, and how much of your attention is much more widely spread now. How much that is a good thing or not, it's up to Tarzillo to control me and make sure that the paper flow into my office is that I'm actually getting through the business. Internationally should be the prime source of our evidence. The idea that everything only happens in the United Kingdom is touching, but of course completely wrong. And we're going to see from North America a whole bunch of different examples about the legalization and regulation of recreational cannabis. There are lots of examples in North America about the right approach to medicinal cannabis and what's the right regime for doctors' prescription and everything else. And equally, right across the rest of the world is then also producing the evidence of the horror stories of the global cost of prohibition. If you want to, I went to Iran on a visit in 2007. In the previous year, they had lost almost 3,000 border guards fighting the drugs gangs smuggling opium or heroin over the border from Afghanistan. They were fighting a war which we were blissfully unaware of, but a horrifying cost. And you could see the impact of drugs on society in Tehran as well on the streets. And equally, obviously, you then look at the example of what's happened to Mexico. 30,000 dead in the last year, just in the wars between the cartels and about ownership of this business. It is, and so internationally, we look at what is happening and the catastrophe that is drugs policy, implications of it. There is the evidence for why our global policy has been for five decades a copper-bottom disaster.
I think, unless you've got anything else to say, that's a good wrap-up point.
Very briefly, just on what Crispin touched on there, looking at international evidence, and I've got a statement that was made today, and I'm concerned over the medical cannabis, because the statement says, part one of the commission will consider the evidence available for the medicinal therapeutic benefits of cannabis-based medicines, and I really wanted them to go and say they would take on board evidence gathered already abroad, and they haven't quite come out and publicly stated that. Had he said he was going to go to the places where we know 30 of the United States and 13 countries and take on board the medical evidence already gathered, I would have thought, okay, fine, now we're moving really forward at pace. If we're going to stop and do all that work all over again, it's going to slow the process down. But I say that's only the written word. Maybe verbally he would say something different.
And again, one very quick point then. Can I tempt you into making a prediction? Where do you think...
England will win the World Cup.
There you go.
I got them an office sweepstake.
John makes our little social media characters up for us. We need that as the quote, I think. This time next year, where do you think we'll be?
I genuinely don't know. I'm not an experienced enough politician to see how these things can move on. Crispin's got much more experience than I have. I know where we'd like this to be. We all know where we'd like to be. A year is a year long enough to have it, to have medical cannabis available under prescription from GPs. I would like to think so. I doubt very much it will be at that stage. I think, given the what they're trying to set up now and what we can already predict is going to happen, a year from now, we will be clamouring for that to happen. Whether it's that we've got over that line or not, I would like to think so. I continue to be a little bit sceptical.
And Crispin?
No, we'll be on the way there. Exactly how far we've got on the journey to actually have proper access to medicine derived from cannabis widely available. There's still a shed load more research to be done. Though, but, you know, we're decades behind because of where cannabis was listed in 1961. So there's a lot of, in that sense, research catch-up to do. And it's a tricky area to research in because you're not dealing with a single molecule, you're dealing with a whole plant product. And so the science has got to come to terms with it's actually rather more complex to assess than some other medicines. But we will be well on the road. Today was a seminal day in achieving that. And so in that sense, I get the sense today was the kind of strategic change. And we've then just got to hold the government's feet to the fire to make sure that this that they proceed at satisfactory pace to get this done. On the other issues around the wider debate around prohibition, we're still going to be in an evidence-taking session. So we've got the opportunity to look and see what's happening in North America around the legal and regulated cannabis markets they're establishing. And there is going to be, obviously, a strong debate there about the evidence that comes out of it. One heard some American on the Today program this morning who is from the prohibitionist side trying to draw out from particular statistics that it wasn't going so well in Oregon and plainly the one thing's not accounted for. The massive strength of the argument and all the overall public benefits that there are to harm reduction to society, those arguments are on our side. We've got to now take the opportunity to get the evidence into the UK, and then hopefully the two main parties here will at some point get to a place in the British system. The assessment will have to be done by a Royal Commission, which will then get us politicians collectively out of the hole that we're always tempted to get into is, you know, drugs are bad, they are banned, because that's a safe place, that's a safe moral place to be. The fact that it has frightful consequences, it's clear that we have got to demonstrate what the frightful consequences are, and that's why, you know, Neil's book is utterly brilliant, and it's going to be a fantastic tool in making the case.
And JS.
Oh, geez, well,
I think you wanted one more.
Very briefly, just if the government's going to do this great research into the hemp plant, I hope you really do it in the round. Understand that the hemp plant itself could be planted in vast quantities. It's good for the soil we grow it in, and it can be made almost anything you can make out of plastic, you can make out of the hemp plant, and it's completely biodegradable. So they've got a whole range of problems they can address just by looking at this wonderful plant.
Well, I think if everybody's lost enough weight in sweat, you can call that. If you can give a massive round of applause, and thank you, Crispin Blunt, Ronnie Cowan. And thank you all for coming and weathering this, and thank you for Tarsalo for organising this, and thank you to everybody that came. Have a great evening, wouldn't you?
Well, it was an historic day, and I think it's fairly apt to say that might be an historic podcast. It was certainly a moment in time that we managed to capture. And on the subject of that, I've just recently published a blog on Virgin saying that we're looking for donations of a conversation. And I know that's a really PR marketing way of wording it, but basically, as we heard from this conversation just now, they work, they help. Public figures, people that have been involved in this drug policy, people that have been affected by drug policy, MPs, Lords, these are all people we need to speak to. These all help push this conversation forward. So if you can think of anybody, please tweet them, please let them know. If you can actually get someone to come on the podcast and show an interest, please do. And also, if you can share this podcast around, it really helps. So thank you for doing all the support and listening that you do. And while I'm on the subject, thank you so much to John Harris, the Distraction Pieces Network social media worker. He does so much. Please listen to his podcast, The Dream Factory. Please listen to Say Why to Drugs with Susie Gage. Susie was in attendance for that podcast, and I wanted to speak to her, but we ran out of time because Susie has created such a platform for non-biased scientific education on drugs, and that is so necessary. So thank you so much for Susie for your support, and thank you for doing what you're doing. And of course, the other Distraction Pieces Network guys, thank you Scroobius Pitt for just being an absolute legend for having us on there and getting us where we are today. Thank you to Chris and Stu, Hardcore Listening, please listen to them. And of course, Tuesday Night Draw with Jim Smallman, please listen to him as well. And also our social media as well, of course, Leap UK, at UK Leap on Twitter, ukleap.org on the internet, at UK Leap on Instagram, and ukleap.org on Facebook. And of course, I need to thank My Name Is Ad as well. He does all of our artwork for us. He's just recently added on our award laurels. Thank you so much for that. John Cross, thank you for all you're doing on Elite UK social media. And thank you so much, Nikki and Tristan, the producers of Stop and Search, who give up so much time and effort to this. And I think on that ramble, I'm done. So on that historic occasion, I'm signing off. Thank you so much for listening to Stop and Search. I'll see you on the next one. Bye. Behind your barricade.
Yeah, but how long can I stay behind your barricades, where true values seldom stray?
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.